From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is extreme vetting Trump's invisible wall? I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Elney, and this is To the Point. President Trump promised to tighten borders and build a big, beautiful wall. Both easier said than done. His travel ban is stuck in court, while Mexico and Congress are so far not ponying up for the wall. But the administration is quietly moving forward in other ways. It's using back channels to implement so-called extreme vetting of people seeking visas to the U.S. And even though many Republicans are wary of paying for a southern border wall, private companies have submitted their construction bids. Border security, Trump style. We get an update. And on today's Talking Point, Senate Republicans take aim at Planned Parenthood. We look at the policy behind yesterday's dramatic vote. First, the news.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Back with To the Point, I'm Barbara Bogave for Warren Olney. Coming up, President Trump has promised tightened borders and a big, beautiful wall. Now he's quietly moving forward on those pledges despite legal and financial challenges. The slow creep of Trump's security policy. That's just ahead. And later on our Talking Point, the U.S. Senate voted yesterday to allow states to block federal funding for family planning clinics that offer abortions. It's not a full-on defunding of Planned Parenthood, but the fallout for women's reproductive health, especially low income women, could be far-reaching. First, this news. Two new executive orders from President Trump today aimed at reshaping U.S. trade policy. One puts in place a wide-ranging study of America's $500 billion deficit with our largest trading partners. The other has to do with preventing foreign manufacturers from undercutting U.S. companies selling goods at fair prices. The orders come just 1 week before Trump meets with President Xi Jinping of China, a country the president has repeatedly accused of unfair trade practices. Peter Nicholas is White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and it's good of you to join us.
Hi, Barbara. Good to be with you.
Let's start with the first order, the U.S. trade deficits review. What does that involve?
Well, this is a study, pretty comprehensive look at the United States' trading relationships with various countries. It's going to take 90 days, and it's going to be a nation-by-nation review of essentially how the U.S. is doing in its trade dealings with these countries, which countries are using unfair practices, which countries are engaging in exploitative arrangements that are disadvantaging U.S. workers and costing America jobs. The report will go back to President Trump, and he'll be able to use it. He'll have some empirical data. He'll have some facts in front of him as he goes about trying to reset trade relations so that the American workers are in a better position.
And right, do we need this kind of study, or is it a strategic move in the administration's way of covering its back if it moves forward?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on. I think one is certainly he wants to make good on a campaign promise that he is concerned about our trade relationships and wants his voters to know that he's doing something about it. Now, what he's doing is relatively modest here. This is just a study. This is not tearing up NAFTA and starting all over again. You know, this is relatively modest compared to some of his rhetoric on the campaign trail, but it's something. It's something he can say that he is doing, and he can say that he'll have better information in front of him and not days, and he'll be able to make some decisions, and he can point to the study as a basis for them.
And now to the second, the anti-dumping enforcement order. What is that? What industries does it take aim at, and why does the administration think it's warranted?
Well, what the administration is saying here is that there's close to about $3 billion in penalties and various duties that have not been collected because our method of collecting penalties from countries that are illegally dumping goods on our markets, or cases where countries are illegally subsidizing companies that are trading with the United States, that these methods are kind of porous, and there's a lot of money that we're leaving on the table. We're simply not collecting it. So this is an attempt to make some technical changes in our methods of collecting these funds that supposedly will help to correct this problem. So, for example, it gets a little bit in the weeds here, but importers are required to put up a kind of insurance bond. And the Trump administration is claiming that this method of insurance doesn't do enough. It's kind of weak. It doesn't do enough to hold them accountable for defaulting on obligations to the U.S. So it would strengthen that form of insurance bond.
And bring China into this. The administration is saying, no, we're not intending to put China on warning before the president arrives for his visit. But...
Yeah, that was a funny moment. So we had a briefing in the White House yesterday led by Peter Navarro, who's a trade official for the Trump White House, and also Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary. And they made a point of saying this is not about China. Don't focus on China. This is broader than that. But at the same time, they did go out of their way to mention that our greatest trade deficit is with China. And they, highlighted that point. And then the president, the same day, yesterday, also issued some tweets with regard to China, saying that that American workers are suffering and disadvantaged because of unfair trade practices perpetrated by China, and that this is going to come up next week when the president meets with his counterpart Xi at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach. So I think that it would be naive not to think that this isn't a message to China coming just a few days before that summit meeting.
And how are we supposed to understand that? Because didn't Trump promise to name China a currency manipulator on day one, and then he seemed to really go at China, now backing away a little bit and back and forth.
That's a really, really good point. It's sort of hard to find consistency here because, yes, he did say that on day one China would be labeled a currency manipulator. That hasn't happened. He also, before being sworn in, took a call from Taiwan, and that jeopardized our relationships with China. But he's backed off that, too, and is now embracing the one-China policy. So we've had mixed messages coming from the White House with respect to China. I imagine all of this is going to get sorted out and talked through at Mar-a-Lago.
So just very briefly, is this just a first step in renegotiating NAFTA?
Well, I think that he has taken some steps towards reviewing the NAFTA agreement, but what our paper's written and our colleague of ours has written is that those steps seem relatively modest, that the changes he's proposing really don't go all that far, and this is not a rewrite of NAFTA that he envisions, more modest.
And we'll be talking with you, I'm sure, many times. Peter Nicholas, he's White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks again.
Good to be with you, Barbara.
Just ahead, how the administration is quietly moving forward with two tent poles of Trump's controversial immigration policy. Back in a moment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave. President Trump promised to tighten U.S. borders by restricting travel and building his big, beautiful wall between America and Mexico. But legal challenges to his travel ban and Mexico's refusal to foot the construction bill are making it hard for him to deliver. Nevertheless, the administration is moving forward on both fronts. They've opened a $600 million bidding contest for construction on the border wall. We'll get an update on that coming up. And in the past 2 weeks, the administration implemented a new policy of extreme vetting of visa applicants, one of Trump's signature campaign promises, but without the fanfare. And this vetting was revealed in a series of diplomatic cables sent by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to embassies and consulates explaining the new policy. Yegena Torbati covers the State Department for Reuters and broke the story. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
Well, what a scoop. How did these diplomatic cables land in your hands?
Right. So me and my colleague, Michael Rosenberg, and others here at Reuters have been reporting on the ramifications of President Trump's executive order and his aim to tighten visa vetting procedures. And through that process, we received a tip that there had been a cable sent on March 15th that addressed the executive order. Through our reporting process and through sources, we were able to obtain that cable, and then also found out that there were subsequent cables that addressed the court decision that enjoined or put a stop to parts of the order. And so eventually, through sources both in Washington and abroad, we were able to obtain all four cables. And it kind of really laid out in black and white both what the administration intends to do, some of the obstacles to those intentions, and then what remains in place even despite the court order.
Well, good thing, because the story really seemed to go under the radar, right? It coincided, the cables coincided with the hullabaloo over health care in Congress.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, there's been so much good reporting, not just from us, but from so many different outlets, and it's a very high news environment right now. So it's hard for any one story to have a lot of lasting power. But we did feel that this was a significant one.
Well, I know there's some confusion and there's some retractions in these cables, but briefly, what instructions does Tillerson lay out for vetting, new kinds of vetting in them?
Right. So the things that still remain in place, that even despite the court orders, are still, to the best of our knowledge, in place and active, are a requirement that U.S. embassies and consulates basically identify what are called populations warranting increased scrutiny. And then Secretary Tillerson in the cable directs consular officers to, when they come across an individual from one of these populations, to consider, increased vetting or like a higher level security check for those individuals. So we don't exactly know what that means. What is a population warranting increased scrutiny? And people that we spoke to, immigration attorneys and refugee advocates, were concerned that sort of broad language would open up consulates to being able to, restrict someone on the basis of nationality or religion. That was one concern that we heard. And then the other thing that remains in place is basically a mandatory social media check for any visa applicant who has been present in territory that is held by Islamic State. And Islamic State, as you know, is the jihadist militant group that, has controlled really large portions of Syria and Iraq. It's sort of on the back foot now, but it has controlled really major population centers in both those countries. And so that could, potentially include tens of thousands of visa applicants, depending on how many of those people actually want to come to the U.S. And so that, our sources told us that would be a pretty significant ramp up in social media screening conducted by the State Department if that were to go into place.
Okay. And on the ground, then, what does that mean? Who is this impacting foreign visitors from all over the world, or what regions are most likely to be impacted?
Well, at least from what we've heard from immigration attorneys, I mean, you could sort of surmise that it's going to be a lot of people from the Middle East, from potentially East Africa, from Southwest Asia. And as other reporting has pointed out, these guidelines don't apply to individuals who come from countries that are eligible for the visa waiver program, essentially citizens of many Western European countries and U.S. allies in East Asia that don't have to apply for U.S. visas. So what's sort of left is many countries in the Middle East, in parts of Africa, other parts of Asia.
And just to step back for a moment and get a wider lens on this, it's widely noted that vetting was already extremely strict before Trump came into office. So how different is it now, given these new instructions?
Right. I mean, that was another thing that we heard from, especially from immigration attorneys. They were like, look, my clients, when they come from one of these countries, it already takes months, sometimes more than a year, just to get a visa, even just a travel visa, not a permanent immigration visa. And so this vetting was already quite stringent. This does represent another layer added on top. We don't know exactly yet, because it's only been a couple weeks since the visa was since these instructions were issued, we don't exactly know yet what the impact is going to be on wait times, on actual issuance of visas. Some of that still has to play out a little bit.
Well, I want to bring in Noreen Shaw. She's Director of National Security and Human Rights at Amnesty International. And good of you to join us as well. Are you with us? Do we have you on the line, Noreen Shaw?
Yes.
Hi, welcome. Here we go. There's a sense among the public that since the federal court order, the travel ban is currently blocked by a federal court, that foreign travel to the U.S. hasn't really changed all these that much. So how do you see these cables by the Secretary of State changing that scenario? Does it amount to an end run around the courts enjoining the travel ban?
I think it absolutely does amount to an end run, and it's actually incredibly frightening to think that after what is almost an unprecedented amount of public outrage and concern from members of Congress about a change to our rules for people coming into this country, that the Trump administration would essentially just say, well, we're going to do it anyway, but we're going to do it behind closed doors. We're going to do it with less fanfare, but we're still going to do what we said we'd do all along, which is essentially turn our backs on the rest of the world, try to shut our doors, and put a stamp of approval on decisions that are based on bigotry and discrimination.
And by saying these rules are based on bigotry and discrimination, what language are you referring to? Because some of the language in these cables is very, it seems, intentionally vague. For instance, populations warranting increased security.
Oh, absolutely. I think that you read these cables and they're neutrally phrased and they're even a little bit boring if you just read them straight. The concern that we have and the reason we want to see more memos and all of the implementation orders that the State Department and other agencies are writing up is that they basically will provide a blank check to engage in that kind of bigotry and discrimination. Not that the cables themselves say it, but that it's essentially providing a license to discriminate based on religion and national origin and based on what people say if they oppose U.S. policy, if they're raising concerns about what the United States government is doing. So it's, you know, it looks okay on the face of it, but we all know what's going on in the background, which is that President Trump campaigned on a promise to block Muslims from entering this country and has been scapegoating about and fear-mongering about refugees and immigrants for several months.
And again, looking at the rules, who's doing the reviewing? This seems to give broad latitude to people who work in embassies and consulates. And is that your concern, that will lead to profiling?
Yeah, absolutely. And in addition to that, intelligence agencies and other agencies where we've seen for years, actually, Muslims be touted as a kind of boogeyman and for views of Islam that essentially equate it with violence to be taking hold in some of the intelligence agencies. So there's a lot in these cables that basically reads like to be decided. I mean, there's a promise of additional screening. It's not just that there's a mandatory social media check on certain individuals and this vague kind of concerning language about population sets that are going to warrant increased scrutiny. There is even more extreme vetting to come. And what we're really concerned about at Amnesty International is the debate about that extreme vetting happen out in the open with members of Congress and the public able to understand what's about to happen instead of it being the case that, thankfully, Reuters got a hold of these memos and was able to tell us about it. But otherwise, we just never would have even known what was happening. And so what's happening right now in the courts is just a small piece of it. It's like the tip of the iceberg, and the rest of the iceberg is submerged until it hits us.
So that's why you at Amnesty International are calling on Rex Tillerson to release the cables in the public interest?
Absolutely. We think Congress and the public needs to be able to debate something that has already resulted in so much public outrage. They shouldn't be hiding these policies and then rolling them out whenever they feel like it.
Well, back to Yegana Torbati with Reuters. You mentioned in your articles that some of the cables have instructions concerning social media investigation and social media vetting. And I am seeing headlines today alleging that people are facing kind of digital strip searches already at borders. What do the cables say?
Right. And if I could just go back to something that Noreen said and something that was in your question regarding maybe this perhaps being a backdoor, just to kind of give the State Department's perspective, I think they would say, like, we are very much in compliance with the court orders. We are not trying to, violate any judicial orders. And in the parts of, Rex Tillerson's last cable did rescind instructions that, were relevant to the parts of the order that were stopped by the courts. The things that are in place now are as far as we can tell, fully legal and in compliance with court orders. They refer to the parts of the executive order that remain in force, which is many portions of it, and also a separate presidential memorandum that President Trump signed concurrent with the executive order, which remains in place. On the question of social media vetting, I mean, this is something that has kind of bedeviled law enforcement authorities for years now. It's something that Congress has pushed DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, to do more of, but it is pretty technically difficult, and it's hard to sift through, you know, many posts, and there is so much social media out there in many different languages. It's something that's been done on a pretty small scale by DHS, and as far as we can tell, just from our own reporting, it hasn't been done on a regular, consistent basis by the State Department, by consular officials, and as you know, of course, both state and DHS are responsible for immigration to the United States. State really handles it kind of outside U.S. borders, and DHS gets that responsibility once an individual actually arrives at a U.S. port. And so DHS is a bit more advanced when it comes to social media screening, but even within that department, it's done on a pretty small scale for very limited populations.
And back to you, Noreen Shaw, with Amnesty International. What are your concerns about the social media instructions in this extreme vetting? It could affect people you work with, reporters on the ground in places like Iraq, in any ISIS-held territory who have traveled through it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the first things that occurred to me when I was reading the memos was how it would impact Amnesty International researchers, who, of course, risking quite a lot to go and document exactly what's happening on the ground in some of these ISIS-controlled territories. And the ways in which we already have seen visas, delays in visa processing for people like that, that could continue, and it could become the case that if you tweet something that is critical of U.S. foreign policy, that there's now kind of, again, a stamp of approval for not letting someone in. And, you know, what they may see, the U.S. government may see as an abundance of caution, but we see it as basically ideological exclusion. And this has a huge impact on people who are doing nothing wrong, but their social media could be viewed in a particular way because they are saying controversial things. One of the people that we've been working with a lot over the past few months is a Yemeni American activist named Rabia Al-Thabani, and her husband is a Yemeni national. I mean, she's a U.S. citizen. Her husband's a Yemeni national. He's a liberal journalist in Yemen. He's taken huge risks. He's dedicated his life to challenging violent extremism, and he's worked with the National Endowment for Democracy. But right now, he's not able to get his visa. He's stuck in Malaysia. He's a great example of a person who, if you did social media vetting and it wasn't very careful vetting, he's a person who could be left out of the country. He's a person who already isn't able to get into the country, reunite with his U.S. citizen wife because of unnamed reasons. We'll just never know.
Well, our guest
has been delayed.
And going back a bit to what our guest was saying about how these orders seem to comply with the court order blocking the travel ban, you're a lawyer. Do you agree, and do you see legal challenges ahead on these visa procedures?
So you know, my understanding is that this March 6th, 2016 memo by the president was something that you could say, well, a lot of these instructions, a lot of these State Department cables are coming out of the March 6th memo, and that memo is not subject to the litigation. But taking off my kind of lawyer hat, what I see it as a member, as a citizen of this country, as a part of the public, is that the public has been outraged and courts have raised tremendous concern about the motivation of this entire set of policies. And that includes, you know, whether or not it's an executive order or writing it separately in a memo, essentially providing people license to deny entry to this country on the basis of religion and national origin. So, again, this is not through an executive order with that kind of fanfare, but still the policy of extreme vetting that the Trump administration is trying to promulgate through these State Department memos and other memos that I'm sure exist with other agencies. Can they be challenged? I mean, I think people are absolutely going to challenge these things, but ultimately it's not for the courts to litigate this stuff. It's really about whether Congress is going to respond to public concern.
Well, hold that thought, because we're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more about immigration policy under the Trump administration, and specifically the latest proposals to pay for the border wall.
Warren Alney here, host of To The Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To The Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Olney. And back now to our conversation about how the Trump administration is moving forward with its border security goals despite court challenges. And we were just talking about new State Department guidelines for extreme vetting. Now let's turn to the bottom line and politics of building the big, beautiful wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. T. Christian Miller is senior reporter at ProPublica. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of, among other books, Blood Money, Wasted Billions, Lost Lives, and Corporate Greed in Iraq. And it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Let's talk basics first. The administration announced a $600 million bidding contest for the wall construction about 2 weeks ago. Tell us about the contest. And it sounds like a fast-track kind of deal.
Yes, it is. It's definitely a faster than you would normally see in any kind of a government bidding process. So what the Trump administration has indicated so far is that the first step of building the big wall will be a bunch of little walls. And by that, I mean the $600 million bidding contest, which just opened up, is actually to get contractors to come in and build a bunch of small prototypes. And the idea is that eventually, once those prototypes are built out, they will be selected, the final winner will be selected to build a more permanent, longer wall.
It's funny. There's a line in the literature about the wall having to be aesthetically pleasing, and that's part of the issue with these prototypes. It's like beauty pageant language.
Yeah, it's very unusual language to see in a kind of a government contract. I've covered government contracting for many years. And the only time you usually see language like that is on a fancy project, like building a big new government building or courthouse or a monument.
I see the fingerprints of Trump in that language.
Yeah, aesthetically pleasing is, I think, the closest you can get to a government translation of a big, beautiful wall, which is what President Trump has said many times he wants to construct. So I think that aesthetically pleasing is in there specifically to address the concerns of the president that this not only be an effective wall, but also be an attractive wall.
And I understand these are prototypes, and that's what this initial bidding contest involves. But is there any sense of where these initial small walls, the building, would happen?
Oh, yeah. So we know that that's going to happen in San Diego. They're going to go to a demonstration site, basically, and the contractors will have 30 days to erect something that looks like the permanent wall. And those will be there for, you know, for the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection to test the walls. And they'll presumably use, like, jackhammers to try and get through a wall or tunneling to get under it. And then once all that work has been done, that's when they'll select where the final wall will look like and also where it'll go.
Right. And it's supposed to be attractive only on the U.S. side, kind of the,
yeah,
bad neighbors. Bad neighbors rule. The CBP, as you say, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, is in charge of this. What criteria are they applying to guide who wins this contract?
Well, so one of the criteria is to be able to, the wall is supposed to be able to withstand any kind of attack against it for at least an hour. And the idea there is that I don't think there's many people who believe that a wall will just sort of completely deter anybody from attempting to break in, but that if they do break in, there's enough time for Customs and Border Patrol agents to get to the scene and detain and arrest a drug smuggler or somebody who's trying to come across into this country. So the idea is that they have to be able to withstand attack from any number of means, like I said, up to including like jackhammers and tunneling under the wall and attempts to scale the wall as well.
I do feel we have to talk about the surreal nature of even this conversation. I'm thinking of the sobering statistic that keeps popping up that in 7 years, maintenance on any wall would cost the same as the wall itself, that there are so many in America who thinks this wall is a untenable proposition. And you wrote about Iraq reconstruction and that this process is reminding you of that.
Yeah, there's this kind of so I did cover the initial effort to put up school clinics and hospitals and build new facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I have had flashbacks in covering this wall that there's a lot of similarities in terms of the speed with which it's going on, kind of the uncertainty of how it will be built, what kind of funding is going to pay for it. There's just a lot of questions that surround this whole process right now, and we don't know what it will eventually look like. And so I am having that kind of, oh, this is kind of how it was in the early stages of the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan when the U.S. came in and tried to build a bunch of things, and they just didn't really know a lot of details or specifics about it.
T. Christian Miller with ProPublica. Let's bring in Andrew Taylor. He's the congressional reporter for the Associated Press. Nice to talk with you, Andrew.
Nice to talk to you.
So where does the budget stand for the wall? We have this government-wide spending bill that has to be done by April 28th, and Easter recess is coming up, and Trump wanted progress on the wall to be just the signature of his first 100 days in office, and that lands on my birthday, on April 29th.
Well, April 29th is also the 100th day of his presidency, and that would be when there would be a shutdown if they can't get this big bill through, and the money for the wall is possibly the biggest sticking point. But what seems to be going on is that, in fact, due to the way the request falls in the middle of the year, and you know they can't get much money done by September, they actually have a very small request for the wall, and so I think they're trying to sort of massage it. Actual construction is only like $1 billion. They may not give very much for that. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the wall isn't very popular. And it's not just unpopular with Democrats. It's unpopular with Republicans, and particularly, you know, some of the pretty conservative Republicans who live along the border. I mean, because they've experienced it, they know that there are some places where it just doesn't make sense to build a wall. For long stretches in Texas, there's eminent domain has been tested and the government has lost all these cases. There's Indian reservations, there's national parks. So it's not particularly popular, and that argues for trying to find a way to say you're doing something but really not spending that much money or actually following through. And
well, is that where this proposal that came up yesterday is coming from, that House Republicans proposed that immigrants pay for the wall by paying a 2% fee on money that they send back to relatives or people in their home countries? Are they just clutching at straws there?
Well, that's the first I've heard of it, but that just sounds like a Hail Mary pass. I mean, that's not very serious.
So Democrats, aren't they saying not one penny can go to the wall? They'll shut down?
Well, Democrats are saying that they won't vote for any bill that contains money for the wall. However, you know, some of the segments that they're, you know, some of the other things they're talking about, you know, technology or road building to make it easier for Border Patrol people to intercept people in the middle of nowhere. You know, those are the types of or drones or sensors or, you know, things that might make more sense than just building a big, beautiful wall in the middle of nowhere. Those might get some traction with Democrats. But the underlying dynamic is that they can't pass this big spending bill without Democratic votes. And Republicans don't want to shut the government down. So Republicans seem to be trying to find a way to kind of massage the whole issue and sort of get through this immediate sort of bind that they're in.
Getting back to T. Christian Miller with ProPublica, now, on a different front, Trump pledged over and over again that his administration would follow two simple rules, buy American and hire American. So how does this bidding process deliver on those two guiding principles?
Well, it's much more difficult, as President Trump has found, to make a promise over Twitter versus the reality of governing. And the reality is that the Buy American sounds good, but the U.S. is involved in a bunch of trade agreements with foreign countries, among them Mexico. And so under those agreements, we have to open up bidding on any kind of a construction project that's a substantial amount of money. So the bottom line is, Trump may wish to buy American, but the U.S. has binding treaties with other countries, which says, no, you have to throw open a contest to any kind of a supplier from any country. And as far as I know, there's not a way for him to get around that issue. So he may wish to buy American, but the when it comes down to it, you really can't require that.
So you can't get around these free trade restrictions with an executive order or just ignore them?
Oh, he can. Sure, he can ignore them, and he can just go ahead and go about his merry way. But that would invite a trade battle. It would invite possible resolution in front of a trade court, and it would cause a lot of bad feelings. Not that he's shown any particular reluctance to do that, but that option is available to him, but it would meet with resistance.
And I imagine there are other issues complicating this, the geographical challenge of these remote areas where this building along our southern border is supposed to go. You can't buy American and hire American to construct it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could, but you would be spending more and more and more money. I mean, obviously, if you don't want to buy the closest suppliers, obviously, to provide material to build the wall are companies that are near the border, and at least half of those companies are on the Mexican side of the border. So you can insist upon having cement from a U.S. manufacturer, but the cost of sort of transporting and getting that cement and that concrete to the middle of nowhere would dramatically drive up the price. So even if he could require to buy American and made that happen, he would then face the problem that his wall would get even more expensive. And you've just heard, there's not a lot of appetite anywhere to fund the up to $21 billion has been estimated a full wall would cost.
And the Mexican government, of course, has refused to pay for the wall. And I'm seeing today headlines about Mexican companies who've stepped forward to enter bidding or to enter into construction have gotten death threats.
I think that if you're referring to the Washington Post article, there's been a lot of Latino-owned businesses in the U.S. which have picked up their raised their hand and said they want to participate in the bidding process. And those guys have definitely gotten a blowback. There's been a handful of companies based in Mexico, and there's the two main suppliers of cement and concrete in Mexico have indicated they want to perhaps participate in supplying for this wall. But there has been certainly a warning from the Mexican government itself, which has said, number one, unequivocally, we're not going to pay for this wall. And number two, if you're a Mexican business who's thinking about doing this, you may want to reconsider.
And back to you, Andrew Taylor, with the Associated Press, talking about the budget for this and constituents, their feelings about this. You mentioned eminent domain. Are Texans in Congress raising concerns?
Well, I think Texans in Congress are sort of caught between wanting to generally seem to stand with President Trump and not really liking the wall. So if you ask them questions about it, they'll say things like, oh, well, I want to see the design, or, well, I've always said we need to do more than just have a wall and sort of circle it back to a more practical design. But I also think, and this could just be, my own sense, but I think a lot of people are kind of hoping that it just sort of fades away, to be honest. In the case of the president, sometimes things that he feels very, very strongly about, like repealing and replacing Obamacare, you know, if he hits a pothole, his feelings can weaken. And, you know, quite frankly, if they put some of this money up for a vote in the way that he wants to address it, which is to cut other programs.
Like medical research and other infrastructure, right?
Well, yeah, I think he probably wants to cut other Homeland Security programs to pay for the wall. But, you know, you can characterize it as you wish. And he sent up this big package which included cuts to medical research and all these things, other infrastructure projects, and all these things that are sort of politically toxic. And he didn't even actually officially submit this round of cuts. They just kind of floated it around, which didn't really seem to serve much of a purpose.
So in terms of the political calculation for the GOP and for Trump, it sounds as if they're not all that concerned of the optics, how it's going to look if Trump doesn't get progress on the wall by this 100-day milestone.
Well, I think, I don't think so. I mean, I think what may end up happening is, you know, a wall makes sense in certain areas. In urban areas, you can build a big, beautiful wall. You know, they may need new designs, or maybe if you want to spend some money there, and then you can say, well, that's my wall. And then, lo and behold, the Interior Secretary or even the President himself will say, well, gosh, I didn't mean to build a wall in Big Bend Park in Texas. And you know, we can we might be able to move on. I mean, let me read you some poll numbers, and these haven't actually been made public, but we did some polling about new spending for the wall along the Mexican border, and it came out 28% favor and 58 oppose, and of the 58% opposed, 49% were strongly opposed. So that's not a very good position to take, even if you know, Donald Trump's political base strongly likes this wall. So, and they're aware of that. And so we'll see what happens.
T. Kristen Miller with ProPublica. We were talking about the surreal aspect of this a little earlier. And it raises the issue that in the 21st century, first of all, we already have an invisible wall along the border. And that modern times aren't about walls, they're about drones and biometrics and cyber security.
Yes, that's true. But the there was an attempt in the Bush administration to create what was called a fence, not a wall. And there was a version of the fence, which was a virtual fence. And that did not actually work all that well. What Border Patrol people will tell you themselves is exactly what Andrew is saying, is yes, walls could help in some areas, but there are other areas where you need new technologies and you need different ways of approaching the solution. And just the bottom line is there's very few people, even in Border Patrol, which want to see a 1,000-mile or 2,000-mile long stretch of concrete wall. Just because it's not proven to be particularly effective or particularly safe for border patrol agents who are patrolling and don't know what's on the other side of the wall. So the constituency for the wall may end up being a constituency of one, which is the president, for pushing his vision as it goes on. There's not many quarters where you find people full-throatedly saying, we want to have a 2,000-mile-long wall stretching from Texas to California.
Well, that about does it. Thank you so much, both of you. T. Kristen Miller with ProPublica, also Andrew Taylor at the Associated Press. It was great talking with you. Thanks for this. And just ahead, the Senate has voted to allow states more leeway in blocking federal funding to family planning clinics that also offer abortions. And advocates say this could potentially devastate the health care network that low-income women rely on for birth control and other reproductive health services. We're back with that conversation on today's Talking Point. I'm Barbara Bogave here with today's Talking Point. Senate Republicans took aim at Planned Parenthood yesterday in a vote that unfolded like a House of Cards episode, with Democrats and two female Republicans opposed. It took a Georgia Republican who just had back surgery showing up in a wheelchair to cast his vote. And Vice President Mike Pence still had to break the tie. The bill now heading to the president's desk would affect more than just Planned Parenthood, though. It seeks to undo an Obama administration rule that prevented states from blocking funding for family planning clinics that also perform abortions. Emily Crockett has been covering this for Vox, where she writes about gender issues. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to talk with you. And before we get into the nitty-gritty here, such drama. Why is this such a priority of Republicans, and why was it this close?
You know, it is, on some level, it's pretty baffling, because when you look at the polling, most Americans and even most Republicans don't really see this as a priority. Nearly half of Trump supporters actually supported or opposed defunding Planned Parenthood. It's just definitely become an ideological priority for the Republican Party, and they've kind of painted themselves into a corner somewhat. And it's just they've gotten very very adamant about this being their goal, and so it's hard to and it pleases their conservative base, so it's sort of hard to back down from.
And the bill, it's pretty complicated. As I said, it undoes a protection that former President Obama very hurriedly put in place before leaving office. So untangle it for us. It's all about Title X funding to healthcare clinics.
That is correct. Big picture, just important to note, because some people are confused about this. This is not the big Planned Parenthood defunding nationwide bill that Paul Ryan had been promising. That bill went down with the AHCA when that healthcare bill failed. That big bill might resurface, but we don't really know. The short version is that this bill is much more. It gives states more leeway to kick Planned Parenthood out of family planning grant programs. So the effects are a little hard to predict, but it will definitely be bad for Planned Parenthood. Now, Obama's rule really just reaffirmed existing law, but there had been some confusion about the implementation and interpretation of this law. 13 states had already excluded Planned Parenthood from the Title X program, but they really weren't supposed to do that. So Obama's rule said you can't do that anymore. But now with this rule repealed, it's essentially open season on Planned Parenthood at the state level when it comes to Title X funding. Whether states take that option is an open question. Now, Title X funding, what's that? Planned Parenthood gets its public funding from two major sources of revenue. One is Medicaid, public insurance program for the poor, and the other is Title X, which is a grant program for family planning services for low-income people.
And we're talking about some 4 million people here.
Yeah.
Primarily of color.
Yeah, mostly women of color. Also a lot of young women, because Title X explicitly protects their privacy and they won't have to have their parents be informed if they're getting birth control, for instance. Title X helps a lot of people who sort of fall in the cracks. It's low-income people who may not qualify for Medicaid but still make so little money that they need subsidies for birth control and other family planning services. Together, Medicaid and Title X make up what we call the family planning safety net, which in plain English is just making sure that poor people can get birth control and sexual health screenings. So these two programs, both of which fund Planned Parenthood, are incredibly crucial for that.
So defunding of Planned Parenthood, but what you write that is important about this bill is that the president and of course, the president's almost certainly going to sign it, is that it can potentially have this domino effect for the larger healthcare network that low-income women rely on for birth control and other reproductive health services.
That's correct. So Title X, again, is a grant program. It is a competitive grant program, and it very specifically funds family planning services like birth control, sexual health screenings, cancer screenings, not abortion. So it funds, it has very specific requirements. It's a very specific grant for specific medical services. And Planned Parenthood, when it gets Title X grants, it gets them because it earns them, right? It is chosen to be a Title X provider because it's the best equipped in a particular community to serve that community with low-income subsidized services. So if you sort of arbitrarily say that Planned Parenthood cannot receive Title X grants just because it provides abortion, then you're going to leave a big hole in that safety net. There's no guarantee that there will be other clinics that are just as big, just as well organized, just as specialized in family planning, that can take on just as many patients as Planned Parenthood. You hear Republicans often talking about, oh, well, we have 13,000 community health clinics and only 800 Planned Parenthood clinics, so what's the big deal?
Right, and they say that they're geographically distributed and near to Planned Parenthood offices and that they provide the same services that Planned Parenthood does within a reasonable distance. And the money diverted from Planned Parenthood would benefit these centers.
Yeah, except that's not true at all. There are many things that aren't true about that. One is that historically at the state level, when states have defunded Planned Parenthood in a similar way to this, legislators have made similar promises about diverting funding, and it just simply hasn't happened. Studies have shown that in Texas, for instance, women just got less birth control and less health care, low-income women.
That was when Republicans in Texas kicked Planned Parenthood out of their health care program back in 2013.
That's correct. Yes. So, and the other thing is that these 13,000 clinics, not all of them are family planning providers. And if they are family planning providers, not all of them provide the same comprehensive range of services that Planned Parenthood does. And even if they do, they may not be equipped to take on as many patients as Planned Parenthood does. The reason Planned Parenthood is so important is because it specializes in this. It specializes in providing providing family planning services, specifically reproductive health care, to low-income people. It's big. It is it's well staffed and expert, and like they know what they're doing, and they serve a disproportionate number of patients for their size or for the number of clinics they have. And in many communities, they're actually the only option that low-income women have to get subsidized birth control, like in 100 some counties in the U.S.
So, and you make the analogy to a sweater with stripes, that Planned Parenthood has one layer of stripes and you pull it out and the whole thing falls apart. But does this only apply primarily to Republican states?
No, not at all. Hmm. This is red states and blue states.
We don't know how it will fall out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should clarify. This particular action, again, it emboldens states that are already against Planned Parenthood to defund it if they choose. So yeah, that probably will be mostly red states. But keep in mind that this situation on the ground, where Planned Parenthood is the only provider in certain counties, is the case in both red states and blue states. And so if Planned Parenthood is weakened at the local level in certain areas, you know, it could have other ripple effects. Defunding, it's going to have some, it's not really clear what the overall effects are going to be.
So looking forward, does that mean a full-on defunding bill for Planned Parenthood is dead now that the healthcare bill failed?
Not necessarily. It could be brought up again. But, you know, what's interesting about this is the reasoning that Republicans use to push these bills. They often say, well, money is fungible, and if you're giving Planned Parenthood money for some things, then you're indirectly funding abortion. But the argument doesn't really work. It's basically an indirect way to try to ban or restrict access to abortion, because for 40 years, federal funding has not been allowed to pay for abortion services. Now, advocates say that discriminates against poor women, but that's still the current law. But they're not satisfied with that. It's sort of a give a mouse a cookie situation, where it's not enough to refuse to pay for abortions. They're also effectively trying to force Planned Parenthood and other healthcare providers to stop offering abortions entirely by threatening to shut them down or hurt them financially or take away all their patients if they don't. It's similar to the global gag rule in that way.
Well, thank you very much for unpacking this, Emily. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emily Crockett with Vox. And that'll do it for us for today. I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Warren Olney, and you've been listening to The Point. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.